Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're diving deep into the intricate world of brain networks.
Right.
The sources you've shared, they aren't just mapping individual brain regions, are they? They paint a picture of the brain as this complex dynamic system.
Yeah, where different areas kind of team up, they form these coordinated networks to do basically everything you do.
Everything from like letting your mind wander to really focusing hard on a task.
Exactly. And this material, it gives us a pretty detailed look at what these networks are, how researchers actually study them, and it explores some of the major players.
So our mission for this deep dive, to pull out the most important insights and really understand why studying these networks is, well, such a big deal.
Yeah, why it matters for grasping how your brain works, both when it's healthy and, when things go awry.
What's fascinating here, I think, is that it's not just about anatomy, like where things are located.
The material really emphasizes that these networks are defined more by patterns of connectivity and activity.
How regions interact.
Precisely. Observed through techniques like fMRI or EEG.
Right.
And exploring these patterns, well, it offers incredibly valuable insights.
Into healthy brain function and also what happens in various conditions.
Right.
So connecting this back to you listening right now, what does understanding these interconnected systems actually mean for how you think, feel, and act day to day? Let's explore what these sources tell us.
Okay.
So pulling from what we've read, how do these sources actually define a brain network?
Well, at its core, they describe it as a collection of interconnected brain regions, regions that collaborate to perform specific functions.
And the crucial point they highlighted is that they aren't these rigid anatomical things.
No, not at all. They're dynamic systems
Yeah.
defined by patterns of functional connectivity.
Right, functional connectivity. So it's about correlated activity across different regions, even if they're not physically right next door.
Exactly. It's about identifying which parts of the brain consistently show synchronized activity over time. You often see this with neuroimaging, like fMRI or EEG. And the material makes it pretty clear that studying these systems, these interconnected neurons and regions using imaging and computational models, that's what gives us those insights.
Insights into how the brain handles things like memory, attention, language, emotion,
All the complex stuff.
and focusing on these networks, this kind of system-level view. Why is that approach considered so important, according to the sources? What's the big takeaway on study importance there?
Well, moving beyond just looking at individual regions helps us understand how the brain integrates information. That's key.
Because complex thinking needs widespread communication.
Exactly. You need coordination across different areas. And what we read indicates this network perspective is essential for seeing that coordination. It also has, significant implications for understanding and maybe even treating neurological and psychiatric conditions,
Oh, so.
because these intricate network patterns are often disrupted in those conditions. So this approach helps zero in on how the communication lines might be failing, not just where there might be some damage. It pinpoints the functional problem.
Okay, so understanding what they are is key. But the sources also detail different ways researchers study them, giving us this like multidimensional picture. What aspects do they highlight as critical?
Yeah, the material emphasizes four key aspects. They offer different lenses, really, for looking at these systems. First, as we mentioned, there's functional connectivity.
Right, how regions talk to each other.
Measuring those correlated activity patterns. It's fundamental, they say, to understanding how the brain integrates information and coordinates tasks.
And changes in those patterns are linked to disorders.
That's what the research suggests, yes. Linking changes in these communication patterns to various conditions is a major focus.
So that's the active conversation. What's another key aspect they detail?
That would be structural connectivity. If functional connectivity is the conversation, this is more like the underlying physical wiring diagram.
The actual
Yeah, the
connections.
connections between neurons and regions formed by axons, those white matter tracks. You typically assess this using techniques like diffusion tensor imaging or DTI.
And the importance of studying that.
Well, the material notes that this provides the essential foundation for information flow. If there are abnormalities here, it can literally disrupt the communication channels.
Which can lead to cognitive or motor impairments.
Exactly. It affects the physical possibility of communication.
Okay, so we have the conversation functional and the physical pathway structural. What about the brain's overall layout, how it's organized for efficient communication?
Ah, that brings in network topology. This is about the organization of the network using tools from graph theory.
Graph theory, like nodes and edges.
Precisely. It views regions as nodes and the connections as edges, and it helps identify key hubs, those highly connected centers that are really important for information flow.
And studying this topology, why does that matter?
The sources highlight that it reveals how the brain is efficiently organized for communication and processing. Certain properties of this organization, this topology, are even associated with the brain's resilience or adaptability, how well it can handle challenges.
Interesting. And the fourth aspect, you mentioned the sources said the brain isn't like a static map.
Exactly. But that's the concept of dynamic networks. The material really emphasizes this strongly. Connections and communication patterns aren't fixed.
They change.
Constantly, within seconds, depending on your mental state or even over your lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding these dynamics, well, what we read suggests it's key to flexible cognitive processes.
Like learning, adaptation.
Yes, and maintaining consciousness, even how the brain might reorganize itself after an injury or, you know, during a disease, that dynamic nature is fundamental.
Hmm. What seems really compelling about looking at these four aspects together, functional, structural, topology, dynamics, is how the sources show they give us this much richer picture.
Yeah, it's a multidimensional view. It's not just where things happen, but how regions interact, how they're physically linked, how that structure supports efficient function, and crucially, how it all changes over time.
It really underscores the incredible complexity researchers are trying to understand.
It absolutely does.
And applying these different approaches, studying brain activity this way, has helped researchers identify specific networks linked to specific functions. These well-known networks are really great examples of that study importance in action, right? They show us what we learn.
Definitely.
Let's dive into some of the key ones highlighted in the sources. Maybe start with one that gets a lot of attention. The default mode network, or DMN.
Ah, yes, the DMN.
Oh.
It's quite fascinating because, sort of counterintuitively, it's a large-scale network that becomes more active when you're not actively focused on a task or the external world.
So it's like the brain's default setting.
That's the idea.
Right.
The network your brain seems to settle into when your mind is at rest, relatively speaking. The sources link it to things like daydreaming, mind wandering, self-reflection.
And which brain regions are involved?
Key players include the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex, the precuneus, and the angular gyrus. Quite widespread areas.
And what functions do the sources specifically link to this resting network? Seems like it must be doing something important.
Oh, absolutely. A whole range of internal processes. It's heavily involved in what's called self-referential processing.
Like your inner monologue.
Yeah, your inner dialogue, reflecting on personal experiences, thinking about yourself, and even theory of mind, understanding what others might be thinking or feeling.
Wow. Okay.
It's also seen as the primary network for mind wandering and daydreaming. So it supports spontaneous thought, maybe generating new ideas, planning for the future in a loose way.
And memory.
Yes. The material also connects it to memory consolidation, helping to integrate your experiences, make sense of them, and strengthen memories by linking new information to what you already know.
It sounds absolutely crucial then for our sense of self, internal thought, maybe even creativity.
It seems to be, yes.
And the sources had a particularly intriguing detail about the DMN. Something about psychedelics.
Yes, that's an area that's really garnered significant interest lately. What we read indicates that studies using fMRI consistently show reduced activity, specifically within the DMN under the influence of psychedelics, like, say, psilocybin or LSD.
Reduced activity in the default network.
Correct. And this reduction in DMN activity seems to correlate with subjective experiences people often describe as ego dissolution.
A fading sense of self.
Yeah, that feeling, and maybe a greater sense of interconnectedness with the world or others. The material also mentions increased global connectivity between other brain networks during these states, plus changes in brainwaves.
And the sources suggest these subjective reports share characteristics with descriptions of enlightenment. That connection feels, well, potentially huge.
It does raise a profound question, doesn't it? Or at least it offers a potential insight based on the material.
Mm.
What does this temporary quieting of the DMN suggest about its normal role, its role in constructing our everyday sense of having a separate, stable self?
Right. If dampening this internal narrative network can lead to feelings of unity or expanded awareness, what does that imply about how the DMN shapes our normal subjective experience, our consciousness?
it's a compelling line of inquiry.
Right.
Of course, the sources are rightly cautious. They stress that correlation isn't causation, and that concepts like enlightenment are subjective, individual experiences vary hugely, and much more long-term research is needed. But it's definitely a fascinating area of study they highlight.
Absolutely. Important caveats there. Okay, so while the DMN handles our inner world, our self-reflection, the sources also detail a network that's all about focusing outward on tasks, the central executive network.
Right, also known as the frontoparietal network, or CENFPN. This one is often described in the material almost like the brain's command center for higher order thinking.
Higher order cognitive functions.
Yeah. It gets strongly activated when you're engaged in demanding tasks that require real mental effort and control.
And the key regions here.
We're talking about the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the posterior parietal cortex, and parts of the frontal eye fields, areas known for executive functions.
So what are its key functions then that make it the command center?
This network is essential for things like working memory holding and manipulating information in your mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
Attentional control, directing your focus, filtering distractions, decision-making, planning, problem-solving.
Cognitive flexibility, too, like switching between tasks.
Yes, and inhibitory control, basically resisting distractions or stopping yourself from doing something impulsive. So when you're really struggling to stay focused on, say, a tough report or making a complex decision.
It's this network doing the heavy lifting for you.
That's the idea. Its importance is pretty clear.
Yep.
It's crucial for goal-directed behavior. Cognitive control. And dysfunction here is implicated in conditions like ADHD, schizophrenia, and traumatic brain injury.
Okay, so if the DMN is for internal reflection and the CDN is for focused external action, the sources also described a network that sort of acts as a go-between.
That would be the salience network, or SN.
Yeah.
Ontario characterizes it as a kind of vigilant sentinel.
The sentinel.
Yeah, constantly monitoring both your internal bodily states and what's happening in the external environment. Its job is to identify what's most relevant or salient right now.
And its primary role, according to the sources,
is regulating the switching between the DMN and the CEN, essentially deciding which network needs to be dominant based on the information coming in.
So it acts like a dynamic switch operator.
Precisely. It assesses the significance of stimuli, like, is this emotionally important? Is it novel? Is it potentially threatening? Using key regions like the anterior insula and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex.
And those regions help integrate different types of information.
Right. Sensory, emotional, cognitive info, so you can quickly figure out what requires your attention and shift your brain's resources accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond just switching, the SN is also involved in emotional regulation, social cognition, even pain perception.
And if this network isn't working right?
Well, what we read indicates dysfunction is linked to difficulties in prioritizing information or shifting focus effectively. You see that implicated in conditions like ADHD, anxiety disorders, and schizophrenia.
That makes a lot of sense. If that network is off, you might struggle to filter things out or switch mental gears. Now, speaking of attention, the sources went into detail about the attention network, which is actually split into two parts.
Yes, two distinct but highly collaborative networks. The dorsal attention network, DAN, and the ventral attention network, VAN.
Okay, DAN and VAN, what's the difference?
The DAN is described as the top-down network. It controls voluntary, goal-directed attention.
So when you decide to pay attention to something?
Exactly. Like when you're sustaining focus on reading a book or deliberately searching for something in your visual field or using spatial attention. Its core regions include the frontal eye fields and the intraparietal sulcus.
And the VAN.
The VAN is the bottom-up network. It's stimulus-driven. This is the network that snaps your attention to something unexpected or salient.
Like a loud noise or something moving in your peripheral vision.
Precisely. It handles attentional reorienting. It allows salient stimuli to automatically capture your attention, acting like a circuit breaker, to interrupt your current focus when something potentially important pops up. Key regions are the temporoparietal junction and the ventral frontal cortex.
So they work together. The DAN keeps you focused on your goal, but the VAN is always kind of standing for important interruptions.
Exactly. They interact through complex feedback loops. This allows your attention to be flexible, balancing your internal goals with the demands of the external world.
And the importance here is obvious, allowing focus, filtering distractions.
Yeah, adapting your attention as needed. And dysregulation, as you might expect, is implicated in conditions like ADHD and spatial neglect after stroke.
Okay, Shifting gears slightly, the sources also spent time on what people often call the emotional brain, the limbic network.
That's right. This is a really complex network, absolutely crucial for processing and regulating emotions, forming and retrieving memories, and driving motivations. It's deeply tied to survival instincts and our social interactions.
What are the key structures involved here?
The sources highlight several. The amygdala, often associated with fear responses and tagging memories with emotional significance. The hippocampus, essential for creating new memories and also for spatial navigation.
Uh-huh.
The thalamus, which acts as a major sensory relay station, but also helps prioritize emotionally relevant stimuli. And parts of the prefrontal cortex, which play a big role in regulating emotional responses and linking emotion to decision-making.
So it's integrating emotion, memory, and then influencing our decisions based on how we feel or what we remember.
Precisely. The sources show how information flows dynamically between these structures. It allows us to experience emotions, store memories connected to those emotions, and make choices that are informed by our emotional state. It's also highly interconnected with other networks like the DMN and CEN.
And dysfunction here.
Strongly linked to common conditions like anxiety disorders, depression, PTSD. And it's also involved, of course, in the memory loss seen in conditions like Alzheimer's disease.
Right. Finally, the sources discuss the reward network. This seems pretty fundamental to, well, almost everything we do. How we learn, what motivates us.
Absolutely. It's a key system for motivation, experiencing pleasure, and generally contributing to our overall well-being. The material describes it as the driving force behind seeking out rewarding experiences and forming habits.
What are the core components they highlighted?
There is a ventral tegmental area, the VTA, which is a major source of the neurotransmitter dopamine, often called the feel-good chemical.
Okay.
Then there's the nucleus accumbens, or NAC, which is a primary target for that dopamine. It processes the effects of rewards and is crucial for reinforcement learning from rewards.
And the prefrontal cortex is involved too.
Yes. Parts of the prefrontal cortex are crucial for evaluating the value of potential rewards versus risks, guiding behavior and decisions towards those rewards.
So it's the system that basically makes us want things and then feel good when we get them, reinforcing that behavior?
Essentially, yes. The dopamine release reinforces the behavior that led to the reward, making you more likely to do it again. The PFC adds that layer of evaluation, judging the value and guiding future actions.
And the importance here, especially for study.
Well, what we read highlights its critical role in addiction, explaining how drugs of abuse can essentially hijack this system by causing excessive dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens, driving compulsive drug seeking.
So understanding this network is vital for addiction treatment.
Absolutely. And for understanding other disorders related to motivation, pleasure, or apathy.
So stepping back from all these individual networks, it's really clear that understanding them as these interconnected dynamic systems, it's not just academic, is it?
Not at all. As the material really emphasizes throughout, it's fundamentally about understanding the machinery behind your own thoughts, feelings, and behaviors.
It gives us a framework for understanding why maybe you effortlessly shift from daydreaming the DMN to intense focus the CEN when you hear your name called in a crowd. That's the salience network detecting relevance, right?
Exactly. Or how your brain uses the limbic network to process emotions linked to past experiences to inform a decision you make today. Or even what might be happening at a network level when your attention wavers, maybe issues with the Danvan balance or your motivation falters, possibly related to the reward network.
It gives us a powerful lens for looking at both healthy function and the complexities of various disorders.
A really powerful lens, yes.
Okay, let's try to briefly recap what we've explored in this deep dive based on the sources you provided. We started by defining brain networks not just as locations,
but as interconnected systems defined by functional connectivity, how regions work together.
And we looked at the key ways researchers study these systems to get that full picture. Functional connectivity.
Structural connectivity, the wiring.
Network topology, the organization.
And the crucial understanding that these systems are dynamic, always changing.
Right. And then we explored some really compelling examples of what we've learned by studying these networks in action. The default mode network, active during rest, maybe linked to self and even altered states.
The central executive network, that command center for focused tasks.
The salience network, the vigilant switch operator between internal and external focus.
The attention network, split into the goal-directed DAN and the stimulus-driven VAN.
The limbic network, our emotional and memory core.
And the reward network, driving motivation and habits, both good and bad.
If we connect all this back to the bigger picture, the constant activity and intricate interaction of all these networks, even when you feel like you're doing nothing, just resting, your mind wandering.
Which is the DMN hard at work.
Right. It really highlights how the brain is always active, always processing, always adapting. Which I think brings us to a thought worth pondering. Well, given this dynamic nature of brain networks, that the sources emphasize the fact that their connections, their patterns are constantly changing, capable of reorganizing over time, what does this fundamental dynamism suggest about the potential for plasticity, for change throughout your life?
You mean even after injury, or maybe in the context of existing conditions?
Exactly. The material strongly highlighted that capacity for change. And while it didn't explicitly spell out, you know, how much change is possible or exactly how to influence it, the very idea of dynamic networks seems to open that door. It suggests a possibility for profound adaptation and recovery, doesn't it?
It certainly does. A question that continues to drive a huge amount of research in neuroscience and neurology. The potential for harnessing that plasticity is immense.
Indeed. Well, that wraps up this deep dive into the fascinating world of brain networks based on the material you shared.
It's a complex but incredibly important area.
We hope this exploration has given you, listening, a clearer picture of these intricate systems and why understanding them is so vital. Keep exploring.